ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan, for your Monday. My name's Corbin Middlemass. I'm in my home port, as the Australian cricket team would refer it here, in the beautiful city of Melbourne. Ed Cowan is on the other side of the world somewhere in a completely different time zone. Hello to you, Teddy.
Corby, you're coming through loud and clear, though. It might not be close, but I can hear you.
Oh, too loud.
How are you? No, good.
Loud enough. Beautiful. I'm well. I'm sort of feel like I'm a little bit short on cricket. It's a bit of domestic cricket sort of kicking around. Obviously, I'm just waiting for the IPL to start, I'm sure, like every cricket fan.
Oh, yeah. Are we all?
But not a whole lot of international cricket going on, obviously, for our lads, but no shortage of talking points, which is why we're here to chop it up on a Monday. Where are you? You going to tell us where you are in the world?
I'm in Canada.
Okay.
I'll give you that.
In Canada. Yeah. Hopefully.
Enjoying the winter, a bit of snow, little time out.
I was about to say.
Time out for Teddy before work kicks in again. Next week. So a little bit of work, a little bit of play, a little bit of work. That's my trip.
Yeah. More play for you, I think, is encouraged.
No,
I'm pleased that you're having a little bit of downtime and you're a very busy man. You still carved out a little bit of time to chat to me, so I appreciate that.
I never miss it, Corb.
We got a final in the Sheffield Shield, so South Australia is going to play Victoria. Bit of an anti-climax, must be said.
Huge anti-climax.
Yeah, I know the point system, you know, people are a fan of for various reasons, but...
Who's a fan of the point system? I've never met anyone who is a fan of the most unfollowable point system in world sport. So tell me who's a fan of that. Yeah, are you a fan of it?
No. I don't know.
So you're not a fan.
No, not that we're 0% of this podcast, but I get what it's trying to do, but gee, when you think we could have had this perfect end of the season where, you know, you need to win and you're in and everything else, and all of a sudden after the first 100 overs, gone. 10 overs into day two or whatever it is, or 4 overs into day two. It's the whole thing's already decided. South Australia are through, and, you know, well done to them. Nothing against them, but it feels like the rest of the round now doesn't mean anything.
Totally. Like, there was an opportunity for South Australia, you know, having to win the game if Queensland were pushing hard for a victory, or conversely, if South Australia were struggling or there was a draw going on, Queensland could have set up a game, and instead, as you rightly called out, it's decided on one, you know, poor innings down at Belrive from Queensland not being able to get any bonus points that no one really understands anyway, and all of a sudden, after 10 rounds of the Shield and... Well, you know, 9.5 rounds of the Shield and excitement building, it's just flat. It's
so
muted.
What's the answer? Do we go back to the old first innings points?
There's some middle ground for sure. So what this is trying to encourage is positive attacking cricket.
Yeah.
And so there's a world where, yes, there's first innings points, but maybe you outsize an outright victory. So, you know, way back when you were in nappies, it was 6 points for a win, 2 points for a first innings win. And not an outright win, and obviously not cumulative. So if you won outright and first innings, you only got 6 points.
Yep.
So what you know, there's ways and means that you could maybe manipulate those points. So it's, you know, much more on offer for an outright win to encourage teams to play for it, rather than, you know, this attacking cricket, which is trying to basically say anything after batting for 100 overs isn't really valuable unless you feel like you can drive massive advantage in the game.
And incredibly, we haven't got any top order players in the country, and everyone averages in the mid-30s. So work that one out. And the rules are set up to obviously incentivize the, you know, being a glorified limited overs game. So, I think it needs an overhaul. It's a couple of years in a row that we've seen, you know, the point system obviously play a role in, you know, ladder positions and everything else. I think we had this very similar conversation this time last year. So South Australia were informed of the situation. So Ryan Harris decided to tell his team when they came off at tee on the second day. So that they had an advantage over Queensland, and as a result, they're going to go through and play in the final. The knock-on effect is interesting. So Brendan Doggett, who'd been ruled out for the year with a hamstring injury, is now in the mix to possibly return and play in the final. So he suffered that fielding against New South Wales last month. It also ends the first-class career of Usman Khawaja without him stepping on the park. So he has not played this round due to the impending birth of his third child. So unfortunately, we've seen Uzi for the last time. He played round nine, and that's it for Usman Khawaja. So he won't go around again next year for Queensland. But we've got our finalists now. Starts 10 days from now, Victoria and South Australia at Junction Oval.
Yeah, that's. I mean, it's the right call out. It's sad about Usman, you know, not being able to. I'm sure he'd probably reconciled it emotionally himself, but you know, many of his fans and the cricket fraternity would have loved to see one last game for sure. But you're right. I think the two best teams are playing in the final. The two best bowling attacks are definitely playing in the final, and we know bowlers. You know, bowling attacks win Sheffield Shield. So it feels right. The right two teams are playing. And I think it's setting itself up for an excellent contest.
Day three of all these games. So this is the final round. We've got a little preview here. South Australia and Victoria. Both teams made almost identical scores in the first innings. So there was three runs between them with Victoria on top there. So Victoria got their 300 largely by committee. So 66 for Callaway, 59 for Peake. Two of their young star batsmen. And then Will Sutherland, the skipper, also with a half century. Earlier in the match, Henry Hunt top scored with 81. And Ben Menenti made a late little fighting 53. Four for Todd Murphy, which is good to see after he was obviously left hanging as the 12th man in the back end of that test series in the home summer, obviously in the Ashes. And Scott Boland amongst the wickets again with 3 for 66. So this is well set up. I imagine both teams will be just trying to keep a few cards up their sleeve before the final at the same venue, obviously taking place, as I said, in 9 days from now. Anything jump out at you from that game?
Not really. It's now, I mean, yep. It's just sad that it's going to peter out, no doubt. Who has the better attack, Victoria or South Australia?
Victoria. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Has the better the batting lineup? Toss the coin.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Victoria have a better spread. South Australia, probably if we're picking in the schoolyard, you know, you might take, you know, Sanger and McSweeney Carey. Pretty high or whatever. And, yeah, obviously Carey.
Alex Carey. Yeah.
As part of it. He goes okay. So, yeah, it'll be a fun final. And, yeah, hopefully there's a reasonably good wicket, as there has been most of the season at Junction Oval for that matter. A couple of these other games, just on some individual performances. The 100 for Cam Green obviously stands out. So it feels like the storyline around Cam Green gets reinforced again, that, yeah, he's struggling at international level, but every single time he drops back and plays domestic level, he proves that he's too good for the grade. And so he has, again, here with 135. You can't do much more than that. So it feels like, you know, that's in the absence of, you know, anyone else really knocking down the door for his place in the test team, you'd feel like if there was a test starting tomorrow, he'd be hard to leave out again.
So you're right. Either one of two things happen from here. Either he has a breakout series that puts at least to bed the conversation for a moment, or he gets dropped. And until one of those two things happen, we're going to keep muddling around wondering whether he's the guy or not. And anyone that saw the game or highlights, you know, you watch him bat against New South Wales yesterday and you think he's just too good for this standard of cricket. So, you know, is it technical? Is it emotional? Is it psychological as to why he's not at his best when he's playing test cricket? Which one of those is holding him back from test cricket? And it's probably a little bit of all three. You know, personally, I still think he has a lot to deliver for this test team, and he will. It's more a question of role. And so at the moment, you know, trying to perform the role of a top order batsman, it's bloody hard. And so you just get the sense that he's a number six who bowls a bit. I know he had a little bit of that opportunity during the Ashes, but he's been, you know, all over the place, really. And so to bed that down, he needs a series. But at the same time, it's pretty hard to look past what he keeps delivering in the level below.
It is. And then you look at the rest of the field. So I sort of went through, given the fact we're nearing the end of the Sheffield Shield season. So the guys that have scored over 600 runs for the year, and by the way, the top end of this is Pete Hanscom, 688 at 36. And then it's into Cam Bancroft, 665 at 35. And then the guy who comes in as the third leading run scorer in the tournament this year feels like the forgotten man of Australian cricket, who was the Sprout player 12 months ago, Sam Constance. So he got scores of 38 and 31. He's the third leading run scorer. but he's got 660 at 33. So it hasn't been a year where he's had, you know, big gaudy hundreds or anything like that. In fact, it's been a lot of what he delivered in this match. It's been starts and then hasn't really gone on with it. So for a guy that's averaged 33, he's made 38 and 31 in this match, and that's about what the summer has amounted to for Sam Constance. So how are we meant to feel about him? I mean, he's still such a young player. It feels like his name's certainly not as close to the top end of the conversation as it was this time last year or last winter. And yet he's in and around his peers. It's not as if they've completely, you know, lapped him. He's right there with them. But at the same time, it doesn't feel overly convincing from what we've seen from him.
Yeah, this is an interesting case study, because for someone who's a speculative buy, he's been a model of consistency. So I think he got out for 31 today in the second innings. But, you know, since Christmas, 44, 28, 27, 35, 37, 28, 38. So no 50s, no real failures. And, you know, to be honest, as an opening batsman, that's kind of criminal. To get yourself in and to get yourself out, that's emotional and mental, not technical. And so, you know, to be able to grind out a 70 or an 80 or 150, you know, that turns your season around. But as you say, he hasn't been lapped by the pack. So I don't know whether that says more about Sam or less about those around him. But on the upside, this is a kid. This is a kid learning the game. This is a full shield season in his kit bag that he can draw on and his experiences, and he's got better for it. So again, we're looking for opening batters. No one is screaming out saying, pick me, pick me, pick me. And he's probably only a couple of scores away. So I think it's a good news story. I just don't feel great about it.
Yeah, they're fascinating reading, and this is the problem the selectors are going to have. So say we next play a test match in August against Bangladesh. You look through the lineup and the incumbents at the moment, you think, well, Head plays, Smith's going to play, Carey's going to play. I think Green plays. I think he comes back, scores 100 here. They're going to stick with him. I think Webster plays. Khawaja drops out. So there's five of your seven immediately. You need two more players. You need top order positions. The question is, do you stay with Weatherald? And do you stay with Marnus? So, I mean, Marnus scored good runs when he played domestic cricket, particularly against the white ball. But if you look at the top run scorers in domestic cricket, so as I said, the top end is north of 660, but averages in the 30s. And then you have to go all the way down to 560 runs for a season to get to someone that averages 40, and that's Weatherald, so 562 at 40. Jake Lehman averages 40 as well, but now he's not eligible to play for Australia, nor is he in the conversation to play as a top order player. And then even if you torch the data a little bit further, you go, well, who are the 100 makers? Who are the guys that are going to put up big runs or whatever it turns out to be? Matt Renshaw's got 300, so that leads the way. But then two each for Marnus, for Lehman, for Curtis Patterson, for Harper, and for Hanscom. So they've got 200s, and then everybody else is one or fewer. So that's what the batting ranks look like in domestic cricket for those that are next up. And I feel like we don't even have the Jake Weatherald case like we had last summer, where we felt like, you know, whoever you want to go with, you can always resort back to, you know, there's a standout in domestic cricket. There's no name there that really jumps off the page to me, Teddy, that says, hey, I should knock out the incumbent, even though the guy in the seat hasn't absolutely bettered down his position yet.
Yeah, in this case, the incumbent keeps his spot, even despite the question marks. And you're right, you know, like someone like Curtis Patterson, who we've talked a lot about, and I'm sure we will when we come to the one-day tournament, 200s but averaging 34. So, you know, as a high-quality top-order player, that's a middling season. But across the board, kind of scratching my head, is it the player quality? Is it their ability to translate their technique across formats? Or simply is it that the wickets are spicier than they've ever been? I don't know. I've watched enough Shield cricket to think, yeah, there's some life in the wickets, but it hasn't at any stage looked horrific or unplayable. It does build up, though. I do have a lot of empathy for the top-order players when consistently every wicket has a little bit in it. You know, historically, maybe the Gabba was a bit of a seeming wicket, or Belrive, and then you got back to the Adelaide Oval and you just knew that was a run fest and you could get your confidence back. Every single ground around Australia now seems. Every single one. And so, you know, you can get in these little moments of 5, 6, 7 innings where you don't do much wrong. You feel like you're playing well, but you look at the the score sheet and you've gone, you know, 10 or 20 or, you know, a ball's had your name on it. So I do have empathy for that. That's hard work. And that is probably the difference. It's not that there are wickets with life in them. It's the equality of wickets with a bit of juice in them is probably higher, or the quality of wickets on average is lower.
Hmm. And then the balls, obviously, with the, you know, prouder seam, and I know the players, you know, talk a lot about that. This is where it sort of, you talk about the sympathy for the top order players. Brings me to one guy who's certainly a forgotten player in Test cricket, and I'm not suggesting, you know, for a second that they're going to pick him, because when he was scoring big, huge runs, they didn't pick him. So they're probably not going to do it now. But underrated season, all things considered, for Cam Bancroft. So 665 at 35, which again, you know, is north of his average when he's at his best. But plays half his games at the Wacker. He's batted 9 times. He's the only player in the competition other than Jordan Silk to have not scored over 56 times. So 6 of his 9 hits, he's gone 50 plus. In the end, in a season where runs are hard to come by, as the second leading run scorer in the competition on the back of a horrendous summer last year. It's not a bad follow-up. Plus, he'll get to play in England as well, so he'll keep his red ball form going. But got a little half century in this fixture while Cam Green went large.
That's the sand grabber coming out on you.
Yeah.
It?
I mean, it's going to be an ongoing conversation, though, isn't it, in terms of, you know, where are our batters, who are the next guys, who are the top order players, what's it going to look like, if not now, in the, you know, in the medium term. Just on the last of those games, Tasmania 198 and then 6 for 264 batting a second time. They took a 20-run lead on the first inning, so effectively 284 ahead the last time I checked that score. Queensland all out 178, and as a result, their hopes of making the final went with it. Weatherald 39 and 62, so again, sort of same kind of thing as what we're talking about with Constance, with Bancroft, now with Weatherald, sort of getting out at difficult times. 82 for Jordan Silk in this game as well. And in terms of the bowlers, Mick Neeser, who certainly had a fine summer, obviously playing Test cricket for Australia, 5 for 37, and Xavier Bartlett had 3 last time I checked that score as well. Teddy, the One Day Cup came to its conclusion on Wednesday on a cold night down in Tasmania, and New South Wales have a bit more silverware in the cabinet. There is a whole lot to pull apart from this game, but Curtis Patterson saw New South Wales home with an unbeaten 50, so that gives him 300s and 3 half centuries, averaging over 100 for the tournament. And appropriately, he led New South Wales to a victory here. They had to beat the number one team in consecutive games on their home patch to get it done, and I think that makes you a pretty worthy champion.
Yeah, it does for sure. I mean, in both games, Tasmania batted first, and we know the advantage of chasing runs at Belrive. So they didn't do any justice to their season in either of those innings, and in both of them, really, New South Wales kind of chased it down easily. There were a few little moments in the final, a few hiccups, you could say. I mean, it wasn't an easy target on a wicket that was offering plenty, more like a four-day wicket and, you know, the 120 in 20-odd overs. But Curtis Patterson looked really like he was playing a different game. He was playing a different sport at times. Everyone couldn't put bat on ball, and he didn't miss the middle. So it was a sensational innings. It capped off a fantastic season for him, and a great season for New South Wales, and, you know, a great way to send Greg Shepherd off as the coach.
Well, that's the unmissable talking point, isn't it? So 39 days after he was sacked for essentially not
getting it in. I knew you were going to talk about it, so I thought I'd get it in.
For not winning titles, which was part of the JD. All of a sudden he wins a title, but he's already lost his gig. I think there were reports coming through that he was in the karaoke singing I'm Still Standing. Well, he was for a minute, but obviously this round of Shield cricket will be his last as the coach of New South Wales. On retrospect, Does it change anything as to what it means for New South Wales, whether they got the decision right or wrong?
Well, I don't think anyone's denying the quality of Greg Shepherd as a coach. You know, probably Australia's most successful domestic coach, a fantastic mentor to many great players. I think the question that probably arose was, aside from the titles, is he the coach to bring this next generation of New South Wales players to play Test cricket? I don't know the answer to that. But, you know, there are a few times in the last couple of weeks that you've probably thought, you know, you can see how that decision was made by the CEO, because, you know, when they pulled out against Tasmania 3 down or 4 down with 20 overs to go and shut up shop, and didn't actually play for the win. They dominated the game but didn't play for the win in the end. And then again last week against Queensland, you know, very much the same. You know, so there was obviously rain affected. But, you know, that mentality of playing for win rather than first case is not to lose, then a draw and then a win. I think these young players need instilled in them, it's a win at all cost attitude. They need to learn to win. And, you know, I'm sure that was probably top of mind for the last couple of weeks as well.
Yeah. I think I said this at the time when we spoke about it. It was an error one way or the other. It was either an error to re-sign him at the stage that they did, or it was an error to sack him at this particular point. I mean, the fact that he'd had a two-year deal and he was essentially 25% of the way into it, he was halfway through his first summer of that new deal. So you don't even give him a chance to prove that he can do the job, and then you decide that actually we've got the wrong guy. So you either got it wrong originally or you got it wrong in retrospect. It sort of... And it only feels like he was able to prove that on the way out with a title in the way that it ended. But as it's not going to change anything.
I think that's a fair view to have for the record.
Yeah, it's you know, the task was to win titles. He did it. So new coach, it feels like you put your finger in the wind. Everyone's reporting that Brad Haddin's going to be the guy to coach New South Wales. Is that over the line? Can you give me any insight as to am I waiting for the other shoe to drop? Is this about to be announced or anything like that?
I have no insight here. I'm sorry, Corb.
Okay, so it's not like I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning and they're going to get a press release and say Brad Haddin's a new coach.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay. Johan Buiten's future will be determined on the success of the season, was a quote that I read in a News Corp column.
Whoa.
So pressure on at the Bulls. Chris Rogers off contract in Victoria, but has had a near perfect season. So if he wants to coach again, I imagine that will be the case. Unless maybe another state comes calling. Maybe someone picks up the phone and rings Chris Rogers. He's proven he's been able to develop a whole lot of young talent and turn that program around. And then there's Bo Casson, of course, former leg spinner who represented Australia and played Test cricket, 53 first-class matches for WA and New South Wales. He's the new coach of the team I call the Western Warriors. So he will lead them. Well done to Bo Casson.
Yeah, well, that's a great reminder. I need to text Bo because that's a great appointment. Great person and excellent coach. Someone who actually, behind the scenes, had a big influence on my career at the, you know, in the last couple of years when he was the assistant coach in New South Wales. Just a duck to water when he took on coaching, having had to retire early from cricket with his heart condition. Has the right temperament, has the right technical and tactical knowledge. I think that's an astute appointment. I was very sad when he left New South Wales, but he's obviously a native WA boy and the allure of family and bringing up kids you know, with his Western Australian wife was too great. So he'll do an excellent job. He's got a great squad. I thought that was an excellent appointment.
I saw Tyler Lewis's article in the News Corp paper say that Tim McDonald was among the leading candidates also in the frame, a former teammate of yours, one of Voges' assistants, and it was quoted as saying industry sources say he did not apply in support of Casson. What did you make of that? That basically, I know they've been a unit together for a period of time, but basically said, I'll sit this one out and, that there might be a senior job for me down the track.
I mean, interesting. Mm. I mean, Tim's been a fast bowling coach, you know, made his career as an excellent swing bowler, both you know, mainly for Tasmania, really. And, you know, you got to be a head coach. It's very hard to translate the two, but sometimes you just need a bit more time to develop. I think if I was, I don't know what happened, but I'm sure he probably stuck his finger in the wind and that was probably a thoughtful stand down.
Mm. Just one more before we move on from domestic cricket. I got a listener question during the week, which basically referred to the New South Wales captaincy. Jack Edwards has given it up during the year to Nathan Lyon, to Steve Smith, and then Curtis Patterson obviously leads them in the final and ultimately goes on to become the title-winning captain there. Is this a little sign of what's to come? Will Jack Edwards be the captain of New South Wales next year?
As far as I know. I mean, he didn't captain. He's injured at the moment, so... you know, all those moments of giving up were for a specific reason. Yeah, there's no doubt being an all-rounder, opening the bowling, batting at six, and being captain takes its toll. And when it take, you know, when you're a young captain still learning that, and you're still trying to play for Australia as Jack is, you can imagine the emotion that goes into to these fixtures. So there's no doubt that New South Wales will have to manage that probably a little bit better than they did. But you saw at the back half of the season, you know, that toll started to play out in injuries. So I expect him to be the captain, no doubt. But how that plays out might be slightly different. Maybe he does the 4-day, not the 1-day. I don't know. It hasn't been a discussion yet.
Sounds like me on this podcast, the way you're running through it. I've got to host the show. I've got to give the sharp opinions and lean on all my cricketing experience and everything else to be able to pull us along on the ABC
Mate.
Cricket podcast. By the way, one thing we have done, Declan Burns got on board and he's keeping us all in order here. And after many years of doing it and sort of leaning on our Instagram and our LinkedIn to be able to field questions from our family here on the ABC Cricket podcast, we have an email address. How
what
about that? As a breakthrough,
tell me. I'm gonna send one in.
The email address is ABC Cricket Podcast. That's us.
Oh yeah.
So ABC Cricket Podcast at abc.net.au. It's line and length.
Wow.
It's like Josh Hazlewood.
Sometimes vanilla ice creams taste great. That
the sprinkles are what
vanilla. I mean, that is as vanilla as it gets.
The sprinkles are what you put in the email. So ABC
exactly
Cricket
right.
Podcast. At abc.net.au. So ABC Cricket Podcast at abc.net.au, and we can field your questions on a weekly basis here on our little pod that could. All right, from Hayden from Richmond in Victoria sends me a message saying, "Hi Corbin, love the ABC Cricket Podcast with Teddy." Ends, full stop. "Idea for the 1-day cup going forward requires 11 days per summer. First 5 matches to be played prior or after a shield match," which is how we love it back in the day. You play a shield match, then you play the 1-day game. "Then the next 5 matches played after the Big Bash, 3 days apart, and then you have a Sunday final." So I don't mind it. So basically, first part of the summer, play a shield game, then you play your 1-day off the back of it, and then essentially you have a mini lightning carnival. So 10 matches per team plus a final, total of 31 matches, tournament done. So BBL ends, and then as a way to transition back into sort of red ball shield cricket, we have our 50 over little lightning carnival, we crown a champion, we get it done, we're out of there. What do you reckon?
Love it. Get that on the socials, deck, and you know, send it into Cricket Australia's inbox. Excellent idea.
I like it. You've done well, Hayden. From Trent, "Can you please discuss this on the pod? Nathan McAndrew. He's been high on the wicket takers list for years and he's usually fit. Where is he in the pecking order of fast bowlers for the test team? Thanks, love the pod." From Trent.
Well, he's fit, so that's a starting point. Puts you in the top 10 fast bowlers. I mean, this is someone who's absolutely impeccable about their preparation, their fitness levels, always has been. An excellent bowler and a Trojan-style fast bowler. Would that translate to test cricket? I think in certain conditions he'd have a decent day out occasionally. I don't think... Yeah, I think his test career may, if ever given the opportunity, is confined to very much the fill-in here and there, and he ends up playing 2 or 3 tests. He's not the answer, I don't think, to solve for the next generation. He's obviously aging, but what a custodian of Shield cricket that he's been. It's proven a great story. This is someone who took a truckload of wickets in club cricket in Sydney, a truckload of second 11 wickets, never really got the recognition, probably wrongly, in that state, and then proved that taking wickets is a skill. And he moved that skill to South Australia, where he's really led an attack. But he stays on the park. Excellent competitor, excellent fielder, great person. It's hard to really argue against. You know, hopefully he does get the recognition he deserves, and that would come in a baggy green at some stage.
I think when you were away a couple of weeks ago, Xavier Doherty was certainly pushing his claim, saying, look, he'd be right there. Wouldn't be surprised that his name's been chucked around and spoken about in selection. So he feels like he's high on the list as a man, obviously, that watches a lot of domestic cricket, as we know, our man Xavier from Hobart. Did you watch the 100 auction, the very first auction? Previously they had a draft, but 4 IPL owners obviously now involved in the 100. Did you sit in front of the TV and watch the all go under the hammer?
No.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise
me. Tell
me
what happened. I saw what I saw was the headlines of Beth Mooney, who's now definitely looking for a new house. you know, that was big money.
Nearly 400,000. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, and then obviously the flow through of, oh, this is what happens when private capital is involved and Australia has to sell the Big Bash because otherwise we won't keep our best players, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I did see that headline. I didn't see the rest of it.
16. By the way, we're getting towards the end of March. We were told, Todd Greenberg told us, first quarter of 2026, we'll make a decision on what happens one way or the other, whether we're going to put it on the back burner, whether we're going to make a decision, what's going to happen on the private equity front with the BBL teams. Have you got any insight as to what the go is there?
What kind of insight?
Any you can share, I guess. do you think we'll have a decision? Do you think we'll have a decision by 2 weeks today?
They're two separate questions.
Okay, do you think we'll have a decision by 2 weeks today?
No.
No. Okay.
I don't.
Right.
I don't think there will be a decision within the next 2 weeks.
Okay. Is it moving forward?
I don't think there'll be a decision in the next 2 months.
Okay, there we go. That's all I need to know for now. So that's on the back burner. Beth Moody went for $394,000 in the women's 100 auction. There were 16 women that went total. There's only 7 Australians. 1 Aussie went in the auction. So there's a reason for this. You can pre-sign players. So guys like Mitch Marsh, Mitch Owen, Adam Zampa, Marcus Stoinis, Tim David and Nathan Ellis all went as pre-signings. So Matt Short was the only one that actually went under the hammer and he goes to the Welsh Fire, who spent most of their bucks, $1 million, on Jordan Cox and Joe Root alone. So they spent $1 million on two players for essentially a, what, month-long tournament. It starts on July 21. Berendorf, Bartlett, Dorsches all went unsold. So it went under the hammer, but didn't find a team for now.
Yeah, so what this does illuminate, and it links to the previous conversation, and maybe we'll talk about this next week in more depth, but you're seeing the best players go for more money than what would happen in the Big Bash. So at the moment, when we had this conversation, I don't know, maybe a couple of weeks ago, where it is, you know, given the structure of Australian cricket, it has a lumpy middle, and the best players don't get paid enough, and the worst players get paid too much, and, you know, everyone in the middle, you know, all the boats have increased. And that, you know, that served Australian cricket incredibly well for 25 years to professionalise the game, both men and women. In many ways, you know, that MOU was, its foundation was in a bit of an isolationist market. You know, it was competing for talent against AFL and the NRL and rugby union and whatever. It's now a global cricket market. And so that mentality actually doesn't hold. It needs to be totally thought from a blank sheet of paper. So our best players should be getting more money. There's no doubt about that. And you see that when Joe Root and Jordan Cox go for $1 million. You know, there's probably someone at the other end of the scale that went for $30,000 or less. That's how the Big Bash can actually transform itself without necessarily having to take on the risk of Indian IPL owners, which I think is a dangerous game.
Yep.
Might be the right game, for the record. Don't know the answer, but it's a dangerous game.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I remember chatting to some people in and around domestic cricket where they essentially, I'm not going to name any names because it's unfair to the guys, but if you can work it out yourself. Someone that's been a regular in domestic cricket, for example, say for the last 10 years, but in very few moments over that 10 years, you would think they're about to play for the Australian Test team, for example. They're just a good citizen that, you know, has played a period of time in domestic cricket.
Middle of the road domestic player.
And I remember the person saying to me, hey, what do you think they're on? And I had a stab in the dark or whatever and stuff. He said, mate, you're off by about a couple of hundred thousand or whatever when you put their BBL contract together and you think, that is outrageous money. I follow the AFL where the average, you know, salary or whatever it is, you know, $450,000. Those guys also, by the way, are playing in front of, you know, sold out crowds most weekends or whatever it turns out to be like that. And they're, you know, doing a brutal sport and they're playing, you know, 23 games or whatever, and there's danger money and everything involved in it. Cricket's not the same thing where you think, man, that is like incredible money to be getting that to roll out and play, you know, a 4-day game at the WACA ground or whatever it turns out to be. So how we can, you know, maybe redistribute some of those funds, we'll better serve the game and hopefully keep our stars in it longer.
Yeah, I agree with that, and maybe we can have a deep dive on that another time.
I'm going to put it on the park list. Some other ones, Teddy, just before we go, some fun stuff. I've given you some homework this week, so I want you to see the incident between Mahedi Hassan Mraz and Salman Ali Aga playing in, I think it was an ODI between Bangladesh and Pakistan. Brilliant run out or unsportsmanlike is basically the question we're asking here. So Salmon, who's going very well, he's on 64 in a 109-run partnership. Ball gets knocked back by the non-striker, basically between the legs of Salmon Aliaga, who's standing there. And Salmon goes down to pick up the ball, and he's beaten to it by the bowler, who like snatches it from him, basically from his grasp as he goes down to pick it up. While that's happening, the bowler then turns around and runs him out at the non-striker's end. So in the same motion, throws the stumps down, he's out. So Salmon Aliaga, who was trying to retrieve the ball, is now out of his ground. He gets sent to the third umpire. He's fuming. He's throwing his gloves off and everything else. So I guess the question is, was it sharp by the bowler to think, hang on, this guy's out of his crease and I'm going to get the run out and that ball's live? And, you know, I was always someone, I didn't like the batting team touching the ball anyway. But then Salmon Aliaga, who's basically trying to lend a hand, finds himself run out for 64.
Yeah, I don't love it. And there'll be the black letter lawyers amongst us that say, you know, the laws of the game are the laws, and, you know, don't try and pick up the ball. That's what the fielding side's for. Stay in your crease. You can. But this is, he's not attempting a run. It's not, there's no benefit. I don't know, you're going to shoot back. Oh, how's it different to Johnny Bairstow? I think the ball was still live at that point. He's not trying to help out the fielder. Like, I think that's a different conversation, but, you know, it's a grey area for sure. The cricketer inside me says, ridiculous.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't.
I need to see it.
Yeah. Let's check your inbox. I know you're not big on socials, but I've sent
Sorry,
it to you. I wasn't, as you know, I wasn't all that big on the best I won at the time, but I didn't really like this either for whatever it's worth. Kiwi Brent Randall. This is how I'm going at this stage of the year, Teddy. I've got all these, you know, I've got names of eight teams of AFL sides have gone scrolling through my head. And last week I teased this story and I texted you later in the day and I thought, oh no, I teased it. I never got to the story in the podcast, and you quickly pointed out to me, no, that was actually in our pre-show chat. You never actually said it on the podcast. So here it is for everyone that's been, mainly you, waiting all week for me to deliver it. He was playing in the Plunkett Shield last week. Some of you might have come across this story. 7 for 7 fell in 24 balls. So this is first-class cricket in New Zealand. Randall had 7 for 4 or 4.5 overs, and Northern Districts found themselves 7 for 11. But he created history by becoming the first cricketer ever to take 5 wickets in 5 deliveries. So he took 5 wickets in 5 balls in Napier, which is also known as a triple hat trick. Of course, we always get into the conversation when there's 4 in a row about it being a double hat trick. But essentially, he did it across a couple of overs. And as a result, has got himself a little piece of history. Never before in the history of the game have we had someone take 5 wickets in 5 balls.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
I mean, I was going to say, I've never heard about that before, let alone there's a reason why.
You would have thought like WG Grace's cousin or something was part of a dramatic collapse in, you know, 1700 or something. Like, amazing.
That's right. When the townies were out drinking all during the innings. Yeah.
All right.
That's right. I mean, how'd that come across your table?
Great
start.
Yeah, just spending too long scrolling through cricket Twitter and seeing what's going wrong.
Yeah.
I've finished the internet, so I've done all that, so that's good. Sam and Darren Cheek is the other story that I want to bring you up to date with. This, they were on ABC Adelaide Breakfast this morning. Here's a little about their feet, by the way.
So, Darren, how old are you?
63.
And so you scored 175 runs at 63, and I don't want to, you know, highlight your age, but that just makes it even more remarkable, Darren. I mean, how did you do it? How many fours and sixes did you hit?
Well, I hit 24s and 9 sixes. I'm pretty sure it was.
I want to talk about Sam for a second. So you reach your century; it's a big moment. You raise the bat. What do you do when you've had 4 of them?
Oh, look, it was just crazy because he was. Because in the end, the last 10, 15 overs, he was just getting them so fast. I think his first 100, he got off about 60 balls. We both got the same amount of balls, really, for our 100. But then it was like, oh, I think there was 150 that he got in 9 balls. And then the next one, so it was just surreal. Yeah, it was a wonderful moment.
Very special moment for the family, Darren. So where does it rank? We've got, you know, the birth of your son, when you get married, but to be able to post 590 together, is that the best of all?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Don't worry about the other 3 kids.
So how about that, Teddy? 590 against Morfettville. Father-son combination. Dad made 175. Son did the heavy lifting with 402. in a 40-over match. I just, like, that is just, imagine being on the receiving end of that as a day playing park cricket.
Sounds like the opposition's in the wrong division. I mean, that's that's ridiculous. And, I mean, it's actually hard to fathom. Someone getting 440 overs, that's
wild, isn't it? There's very little of that happening where you are, I'm sure, Teddy, as you enjoy a little bit of time on the slopes. Have a great time. Put work to one side. Just enjoy yourself over there, Teddy. I appreciate your time, as always, carving out a little slice of time for us. And I will chat to you next week here on the ABC Cricket Podcast.
Love you, Corb.